Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Kevin Boyle, professor of history at Ohio State University, and author of Arc of Justice, A Saga of Race, Civil Rights, and Murder in the Jazz Age. Dr. Boyle will talk about his book, which documents an incident that took place on September 9, 1925 in Detroit, when mob violence resulted in the shooting of a white person, and the transformation of the black doctor accused of the shooting into a controversial symbol of equality. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 2, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The event was presented as part of Metropolitan Community College's Diversity Matters film and lecture series. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Metropolitan Community College, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Amy Force, instructor of history at Metropolitan Community College.
Dr. Boyle received his PhD from the University of Michigan, and currently he's teaching 20th century American history with an emphasis on class, race, and politics at Ohio State University. Dr. Boyle has several books. They include the UAW and the Heyday of American Liberalism, 1945 to 1968. He's co-authored Muddy Boots and Ragged Aprons, Images of Working Class Detroit, 1900 to 1930. And he has edited Organized Labor in American Politics, 1894 to 1994, the Labor Liberal Alliance. His most recent book, which he's going to be talking about today, The Arc of Justice, A Saga of Race, Civil Rights, and Murder in the Jazz Age, won the National Book Award for Nonfiction, the Chicago Tribune Heartland Prize Award, the Simon Wiesenthal Center's Tolerance Book Award, the Society of Midland Authors Book Award, and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. That's pretty impressive. Currently, he's working on a new book entitled The Splendid Dead, An American Ordeal. Besides writing, Dr. Boyle has held fellowships from the Rockefeller Foundation, the Fulbright Commission, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the American Council for Learned Societies, and the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation. In 1997 and 1998, he held the Mary Ball Washington Chair in American History at the University College in Dublin, Ireland. 2007, he received Ohio State's Distinguished University Lecturer Award. Will you please help me welcoming Dr. Kevin Boyle?
First of all, let me just thank both Amy and Barbara for being such terrific hosts. I arrived yesterday afternoon. This is my first visit to Nebraska, and it couldn't have been a more pleasant one. So I want to say thank you very much for all the hosting that they've done yesterday and today. And I just want to thank all of you for coming out. I know coming out in the middle of the day for a lecture is not necessarily kind of the most exciting thing to do. So I really appreciate very much all of you coming. As Amy mentioned, I teach American history. And one of the things that you find out when you teach American history is, it's a polite way of putting this, sometimes there are gaps in what people know about American history. But one of the things that they almost invariably know is they know the history of the civil rights movement. Or maybe, to be more exact, they know a story of the civil rights movement. If you ask most Americans, when did the civil rights movement start in America, they'll tell you that it started on a Thursday night, December 1st, 1955, when a seamstress by the name of Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. And what they'll tell you is that by that single act of defiance, what Mrs. Parks did is spark a social movement that swept across the South of the 1950s and 1960s. What they'll tell you is that that social movement raced through the hallways of Little Rock Central High School in 1957. What they'll tell you is that that movement sat down at the lunch counters in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1960, that that movement rode the buses into Anniston, Alabama in 1961, that movement exploded on the campus of the University of Mississippi in 1962, that movement filled the streets of Birmingham, Alabama in the spring of 1963 with children, that movement marched across the Edmund Pettus Bridge on the way out of Selma, Alabama in the spring of 1965. That movement came to an end on a hotel balcony in Memphis, Tennessee, in April of 1968, a balcony awash in the late summer sun and the blood of a martyr. That's the story of the civil rights movement as most Americans know it. And it has become, in many ways, a sacred part of the American memory, a beloved part of the American memory. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But I think there's one reason that maybe people don't think much about, but in some ways maybe one of the most important reasons that's become a sacred story for Americans, because you got to stop for 1 second and think about what that story of civil rights really is. What that story tells you is that white America, and particularly white Southerners, embraced the sin of racism. What that story tells you is that African Americans walked into the face of that sin, that they took that sin on their shoulders, that they suffered and they died for that sin. And by that blood sacrifice, they redeemed the soul of America. In other words, what the standard story of civil rights is it's taking the Christian story of redemption and grafting it onto the American creed. That's what makes it so incredibly powerful. And when I set out to work on the book that I'm going to talk about today, really one of the guiding questions that I had was, what happens if you step outside the standard story of civil rights? If you look at civil rights, not in the South, but in the North, if you look at civil rights not in the 1950s and 1960s, but in a different period, what happens to the story of civil rights then? Does it become less redemptive? So, what I want to do today, if it's okay with you, and even if it's not, because I'm up here and you're sitting there, I just want to tell you a story. The heart of my story is one night, really one moment, of absolute terror. September 9th, 1925, in a residential neighborhood on the east side of Detroit, Michigan. Now, it should not have been a moment of terror. It should have been exactly the opposite. The previous day, September 8th, 1925, a young couple, Ocean and Gladys Sweet, moved into their first house in this neighborhood on the corner of, for all of you who are from the east side of Detroit need to know this, Garland Avenue and Charlevoix. You can see we're all nodding. Oh, yeah, I know where that is. Now, some of you in this room, I have a funny feeling, know what I'm talking about. Moving into your first house, not the second one, not the third one, the first one. It is this incredibly exciting moment. And it's an exciting moment because you are kind of literally and figuratively crossing a threshold in your life. You're entering a new stage of your life. And it's a very exciting thing. Not just because usually you get a month before you have to pay the first mortgage payment, but because you have a sense that you're starting something new. And that's what it should have been for the Sweets. And it's what it would have been for the Sweets, except for one thing. The Sweets were African American, and the neighborhood they were moving into was white. And what the Sweets understood was that that simple act of defiance, crossing the color line in Detroit in 1925, meant that the Sweets were literally risking the wrath of their new neighbors, that the white people in this neighborhood might literally try to drive them out by physical force, by violence. And for Dr. Sweet in particular, he was a medical doctor, not a PhD, which is a fake kind of doctor, but a real one. But Dr. Sweet in particular, there was nothing more terrifying than that possibility. Let me explain why. Dr. Sweet was born in 1895. He was born in Orlando, Florida. He didn't grow up in Orlando. He grew up in a little town that nowadays is about 45 minutes outside of Orlando, right in the center of Florida, a little town called Bartow. Now, what makes that important is that what that meant was that Ocean Sweet grew up at precisely the point where the Southern system of segregation, system known as Jim Crow, was solidified, where it took its final form. And if you know anything about African-American history in that period, what you know is that that process of constructing Jim Crow in its final form was done through the most extraordinary level of violence. Now, I've been to Bartow. Bartow is an ordinary town. There is nothing special about Bartow, believe me. But in the time that Ocean Sweet was growing up in that town, at least five separate times, the white people of Bartow lynched black men. And in the worst of those incidents, when Ocean Sweet was 5 years old, the good people of Bartow took a 16-year-old African-American, tied him to a stake, and burned him to death. In other words, Ocean Sweet knew what a white mob could do. Now, Ocean Sweet's family were completely ordinary people. They weren't well-to-do people. They weren't civil rights activists. They were just ordinary people. Ocean's grandparents had been born slaves. His parents were small-time farmers. Now, I know you're in the city, but I know that Nebraska, I don't know, I think, as far as I know, Nebraska does have a few farms, at least it used to. They were very small-time farmers. They owned a quarter acre of land. You don't get to be much small-time than that. On the black side of town. In those days, if you went to Bartow, there was a white side of town, there was a railroad track, there was a black side of town. If you go to Bartow today, there's a white side of town, there's a railroad track, and there's a black side of town. And the Sweets lived on the black side of town. Completely ordinary people. Except for one critical thing. And when I started working on this book, believe me, I never imagined how important this one critical thing was going to be. The Sweets were devoutly religious people. They were committed members of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. They believed what the African Methodist Episcopal Church taught them, and that's what they taught their children. They had a number of children, and Ocean was the oldest of them. What the church taught them was what we call the American dream. You live a good life. You avoid vice. You work hard. You get an education. The AME is very, very devoted to the idea of education. And you can rise as far up the social scale as your hard work and your talent can take you. That's what the AME taught. That's what the Sweets believed. It's what they taught their children, and they were very dutiful children. But the Sweets, Ocean's parents, were not stupid people. They also understood that in the Jim Crow South, none of this was true for African Americans. There was a new high school in Bartow when Ocean was young, a fancy new high school, very fancy high school on the white side of town. African Americans couldn't go to it. They could get to eighth grade in the segregated schools on the black side of town, and that's it. That's as far as they could go. And that was not good enough for the Sweets. And so the minute Ocean finished eighth grade in that school, 13 years old, the Sweets sent him away to my home state, to Ohio. And in particular, they sent him to a school down in the southwest corner of the state, down near Dayton, a school by the name of Wilberforce. And they sent him to Wilberforce partly because Wilberforce is an AME school, so they sent him to their church school. And partly they sent him there because in those days, Wilberforce had a high school academy. A lot of the black colleges had alongside them high school academies because there were a lot of really intelligent, hardworking, ambitious young African-Americans who couldn't go to high school in the South and they needed somewhere to go. Wilberforce had a high school academy. So they sent him up to Wilberforce to go to high school. And he got his high school diploma at Wilberforce. But that wasn't good enough for the Swedes. And so he stayed on and went to Wilberforce University, Wilberforce College at the time. And in 1917, he got his degree, a BS in chemistry. Now that alone made Ocean Sweet more highly educated than the vast majority of Americans, black or white. Most people in 1917 did not get college degrees. But that wasn't good enough for the Swedes. And so when he finished with his BS in chemistry, he then went to Washington, D.C., to one of the greatest of the black colleges, a place called Howard. So you nodded. I got to tell you my one quick story here. I was went down to Atlanta to give a talk, and I got to talking about Dr. Sweet going to Howard. And in the book, I said in the book that Howard is the jewel in the crown of the black college system, which I thought was a good line, actually. And then at this talk in Atlanta, there was this man there who had gone to Fisk. So let me just say, Howard is one of the jewels in the crown in the black college system. Have any of you ever been to Howard? Couple of people. It's a gorgeous place. It sits up on a hill in Washington, D.C. You go up the hill and it sits in this beautiful quad sitting up on top of the hill. Well, they have medical school. And Dr. Sweet went to Howard's medical school. And he graduated with his M.D. in 1921. It's an extraordinary accomplishment. That is the embodiment of the American dream from one generation, from small-time farmers to the highest of professional standards in one generation. Two generations from slavery to the highest of professional standards. It is an extraordinary accomplishment. And Dr. Sweet, he could have gone back home. He could have gone back to Bartow, because I know that there was no black doctor in Bartow in 1921. So, just think about that. Go back to your hometown. Mom and dad are there. All your brothers and sisters are there. You come back in triumph, provide your community with a service they desperately need. But Dr. Sweet was an ambitious man, and Bartow was a small town. And I'm sure he didn't want to go back to the Jim Crow South. And so when he finished his medical degree in 1921, he instead decided to go to the fastest growing, most dynamic, most exciting city in the Western world, Detroit. I know, this is going to take a leap of imagination. Because if you read the papers at all, you might know that these days, that's not exactly what Detroit is. But it was. 1920s, Detroit was the Silicon Valley of America. It was home to the most important, most dynamic industry in America, the automobile industry. And it was back in those days. We used to have an automobile industry in Michigan, in the United States, and it was in Detroit. And it was the great boom town of the Western world. In 1900, Detroit was the 15th largest city in America. Does anyone happen to know what the 15th largest city in America is today? I live in it, Columbus, Ohio. Probably tells you. 15th largest city isn't that big a deal. By 1920, Detroit was the fourth largest city in America. 20 years it had gone from the 15th to the fourth largest city. It was a magnet for people from around the world, people coming from Eastern Europe, people coming from Southern Europe, people coming from Western Europe, people coming from the Middle East, people coming from Mexico, pouring into this city because it had all these good-paying jobs in the city. Go work for Mr. Ford. Make $5 a day. Can you imagine such a thing? People poured into this city. By 1920, over half the people in the city of Detroit were either immigrants or the sons and daughters of immigrants. It was also a major location for African Americans coming out of the South in search of those same good jobs in the North. 1910, Detroit had a black population of 5,700 people. That's nothing. I mean, more African Americans lived around Bartow than that. By 1920, its Detroit African American population was 40,000. By 1925, it was close to 80,000. As African Americans did exactly the same thing that immigrants were doing from across Europe. They were just pouring into this city, hoping to get decent jobs. And so what you got to do is picture Detroit not the way you might picture it today, but in exactly the opposite way. A city overflowing with people. A city jammed full of people from all over the world. People competing for those jobs. People competing for places to live. People competing for ways to entertain themselves. You got to imagine a massive, unprecedented boom town. That's what Detroit was. And as that happened, as the city kind of exploded, it also became a deeply divided place. In the early days of the 1920s, Detroit was a major center for Ku Klux Klan activity. There were 35,000 members of the Ku Klux Klan in the city of Detroit. And that's members. I mean, that's the people who paid the couple bucks and got the official sheet. Because you can't, if you join the Klan, you can't just like take the sheet off your bed. You've got to buy the right sheet. So you got to pony up a little bit of money. 35,000 people did that. And that's not even counting all the people who were too cheap to buy the sheet but still believed in the same ideas. Now, the Klan was, of course, anti-black. It was also anti-Semitic. It was also anti-Catholic. That was actually its biggest appeal in Detroit because Detroit was a very Catholic city. It was very profoundly anti-Catholic. They tried twice in the course of the 1920s to outlaw parochial schools in the city of Detroit. It was anti-immigrant. In other words, it hated all of those newcomers who had poured into the city, and it drew enormous support for that hatred. But as important as the Klan was, that wasn't the most profound division that ran through Detroit in the 1920s. The most profound division was the color line. Now, I'm not trying to say that Detroit was ever a bastion of racial justice. It was not. But neither was it a deeply racist city prior to the 1910s and 1920s. But as the African-American population rose in the late 1910s and the early 1920s, as more and more African-Americans moved to the city, all of a sudden, whites began to demand things they'd never demanded before. Increasingly, whites began to say, we don't want African-Americans sitting next to us at a movie theater. They'd never said that before. All of a sudden, they started to say, we don't want African Americans eating next to us in a restaurant. They'd never said that before. But most importantly, for my story and I think for the fate of urban America, increasingly, what whites began to say is they didn't want African Americans living in their neighborhoods. Now, Detroit had always had a black neighborhood. It was called Black Bottom, and it ran right around the eastern side of downtown. It's a very poor neighborhood. And it was a black neighborhood in the same way that there was a Polish neighborhood in Detroit, same way there was an Irish neighborhood in Detroit. And what that meant in the 19th century, in the late 19th century, is about half the people in that neighborhood were of that particular group, and the other half weren't. But if you have a neighborhood where half the people are Polish, it feels really, really Polish. And Black Bottom was the same way. It was a poor neighborhood. Half the people who lived there were African American, half were white. They lived side by side, and nobody really cared. And if you were well-to-do, if you were a well-to-do African American, if you were a doctor, you didn't live in Black Bottom. You lived in white neighborhoods, and nobody cared. And I know that's true because there were only 20-some black doctors in Detroit in the early days of the 20th century, and I looked them all up. I put them on a map. They lived in white neighborhoods, the vast majority of them. And nobody cared. But all of a sudden, in the early 1920s, what increasingly whites began to say was, African Americans, black people, they can live in Black Bottom. That's their neighborhood, but they can't live anywhere else in the city. And they'd never said that before. Now, one of the things that historians do is they take really simple things and they make them complicated. Because when you do that, you justify your existence. This is not complicated. What was driving this? A rising tide of racism. Nothing more, complicated than that. As African Americans came up to the city, all of a sudden whites found a deeper racism than they had when there were no African Americans living in the city. And now I'm going to make it complicated. Because the truth is that racism alone cannot segregate a city. It can't. And let me explain why. Let's assume that you and I are neighbors. And you are a nice person, and I, let's say, am not. So I say, African American can't move into my neighborhood. I will not accept that. You say, well, I don't care. Doesn't matter to me. All things being equal, I can't impose my racism on you. Something's got to help me. And that's what happened in Detroit in the early 1920s. In particular, what happened in Detroit, and from a historian's point of view, it's not a hard thing to figure out because it's written down. 1923, the Realtors Association of Detroit wrote into their rule book that if an African American wanted to see a house in a white neighborhood, the realtors would not show it to him. Wasn't there in 1921? It wasn't there in 1922. It was there in 1923. At exactly the same time, the big downtown banks increasingly said if an African American wants to buy a house in a white neighborhood, the banks wouldn't give him a mortgage. Increasingly, the white insurance company said if an African American does buy a house in a white neighborhood, they won't insure it. And the big developers in town, which at that point, because Detroit was a boom town, were building a whole bunch of rows and rows, neighborhoods of new houses. Increasingly, what they did is they placed on the deeds of their developments what are called restrictive covenants. Simply a sentence or two in the deed that says, this property can never be sold to a Negro and sometimes to a Jew. They didn't do that. In 1915, they didn't do that in 1920. They were doing it by 1923, 24, 1925. And the result of that was that it took the racism that a lot of whites were feeling and it made it systematic. And once that happens, once the real estate marketplace takes the institutionalizes racism, then what happens is that you are still a nice person, but you're a fool if you act like you're a nice person. And that's how you segregate a city. And that's what happened in Detroit in the early days of the 1920s. And it wasn't just Detroit. It was every big city. That exact same process of institutionalizing segregation took place. And undoubtedly Omaha, Nebraska, too. I wasn't going to say it because... Thank you. Because I've never been here before, and I kind of hate to say things I have no clue about. Well, it doesn't stop me all the time, but today I didn't think I should. Now, the thing is, when Dr. Sweet came to Detroit, and he came to Detroit in September of 1921, he didn't run into any of this. And he didn't run into any of this because he understood that his patients were going to be African American. And so he did what a smart businessman would do. He moved down to the edge of Black Bottom, rented some rooms out. And when he opened his first practice, he opened it on one of the major thoroughfares in Black Bottom in the back of a pharmacy so that the patients could walk in. It was perfectly logical business practices. But Ocean Suite was a young man. He was in his 20s. And for those students who are here, I'm going to use now a technical historian's term. when you're in your 20s, stuff happens. That was it. That was my tech. Thank you. I'm a professional historian. Don't try this at home. Dr. Sweet met a young woman. Her name was Gladys Mitchell, young African-American woman. They fell in love. They got married. They had a baby, a little girl named Eva. They moved in with her parents. Let me repeat that last part. They moved in with her parents. Do you know what that means? You do. They wanted to move out. And so, in the spring of 1925, Ocean and Gladys Sweet went house hunting. And they found a house on the corner of Garland Avenue and Charlevoix, a very nice house. In fact, it was the nicest house in the neighborhood, which was actually, quite frankly, part of the problem. In a completely white neighborhood. It wasn't far, actually, from Gladys's parents' house. It was about a mile and a half straight south. Maybe not even that, maybe a mile straight south of Gladys's parents' house. Because Gladys's parents actually lived in an all-white neighborhood, too. They were middle-class African-Americans. They had always lived in a white neighborhood because that's the way things had been back in the 1910s. And in June of 1925, they put down the down payment on the house. And that's where the terror started. Because, as I said, Dr. Sweet, Mrs. Sweet, particularly Dr. Sweet, because of the having grown up in the South, he understood this was a dangerous thing to do. He wasn't going into this naively. He understood that there was risks involved. And so what he did all the way through the summer of 1925 is he prepared to move in. He was supposed to move in. Family was supposed to get the house on August 1st of 1925. But he pushed back move-in date to September 8th. And he did that really intentionally because in those days, I know things have changed, but in those days, schools started back up the day after Labor Day. And September 8th that year was the day after Labor Day. And he wanted to move in when schools were in session. And the reason is really very simple, because that means all the teenagers are off the street. And that makes it safer. He asked the police department if they would come and protect the house first few nights they were in the house in case there was trouble. And the police said they would. But the Detroit Police Department was a major center of Ku Klux Klan activity. And he understood that he couldn't trust the police to actually protect him if push came to shove. And so all the way through August of 1925, Dr. Sweet prepared his own defense. He had two brothers who were in town that summer. And he asked his brothers if they would come with him and Mrs. Sweet, first couple of nights, to be in the house. They were going to leave the baby with her parents because you take chances with yourself, you do not take chances with your baby. And the two brothers agreed they would come into the house and help them protect the house. They lined up a bunch of their friends. So altogether, they lined up 11 people who were going to be in the house first couple of nights. Dr. Sweet, Mrs. Sweet, two brothers, and a bunch of their friends were going to go into that house in case there was any trouble. But 11 people just sitting around a house, that doesn't protect it a heck of a lot. And so what Dr. Sweet did is he spent all of August gathering together a huge cache of weapons. 10 rifles, pistols, shotguns, hundreds of rounds of ammunition. And on move-in day, September 8, 1925, they loaded all of that stuff into a couple of big burlap bags, and they walked into the house with it, and they went up the stairs. And I've been in the house. You go up in the stairs in the upstairs hallway. There's one of those built-in linen closets. And they opened up the linen closets, and they put the guns inside, and they waited for nightfall. And they waited for the mob to come. And it came. 7:30, 8 o'clock that night, one of the people looked outside the windows, and as I said, it's on the corner. It's a corner house. Police were out in front. About a dozen policemen out on the sidewalk on the two exposed sides. It's a very small sidewalk, or a very small front yard. Front yard probably doesn't go any farther from the front steps to maybe the first end of the first table there. Very small sidewalk, and then just beyond that, probably not even that much. Police were there, but beyond them, hundreds of white people. Maybe 200 white people, all out on both sides. And so the men raced upstairs, and they opened up the linen closet, and they grabbed the guns, and they went to the upstairs windows, and they had pulled chairs up to the upstairs windows. And they sat there, holding the rifles, waiting for the attack to begin. And nothing happened. They sat there hour after hour. Then sometime around midnight, one little thing went down in that street. I can't tell you exactly what it was, but I've got a good guess. And if any of you grew up inside a city, you got a good guess too. Somebody out in that mob out there took a look at his watch and said, "Oh, geez, I got to go to work tomorrow." And everybody went home. But if you had been the sweets inside that house, you don't just say, "Whew, glad that's over, I'm going to bed." You got to imagine the fear that ran through those people 3, 4, 5 hours waiting for this attack to start. Mrs. Sweet couldn't go to sleep that night. She said she spent the entire night wandering through the house because, you know, you'd just be so on edge. The next day, September 9th, Dr. and Mrs. Sweet tried to act like everything was normal. He went down to work. He went down to his practice. Mrs. Sweet went out. She bought furniture because she had this nice big house. And it was their first house, so they had nothing to put in it. So she went out furniture shopping. And then around 5 o'clock, all the people started gathering back into the house, all 11 African Americans coming back into the house for the second night. Dr. Sweet set up a card table, one of those folding card tables, in the dining room. And the men sat around the card table playing cards, take their minds off things. You know what Mrs. Sweet was doing, right? She was in the kitchen. She had 10 people in her house. She had to cook them dinner. And then about 7:30, again, 8 o'clock, exactly the same time, Dr. Sweet's little brother got up from the card table and he went out to the front window. And the mob was back. Police were there again. But so were those 200, maybe 250 people. It was all happening again. And so the men went back up the stairs and they opened up that linen closet. And Dr. Sweet, he reached in and he pulled out a handgun. And he realized he had to check to make sure the handgun was loaded. And as he tried to check to see if it was loaded, he realized his hand was going like this. Because he was so tired and because he was so scared. And so he went into the front bedroom. And the front bedroom has one of those sloping ceilings because it's right over the porch. It's a tiny room. And he went in and he lay down on the bed. Took his shoes off, make sure he didn't mess up the comforter. Because he thought if he lay there for a while, he could calm his nerves down. And he laid there maybe 15, 20 minutes. And then something happened out in the street. And the people out in the street started throwing stones. And they hit on that tiny little front yard, and they hit on this nice big front porch that the house has, and they hit on that sloping roof. And one of them went through the bedroom window where Dr. Sweet was. And when the men inside that house heard the sound of breaking glass, they opened fire out onto the mob. And they hit 2 people out on the street. One of them was a young man who was rooming. He had rented rooms in the house directly across from the suites. He was a plumber's apprentice, and he'd come home from work, and he was up in the bathroom in the house, shaving, you know, cleaning up after a day's work. And the landlord's little boy came racing into the bathroom. And this is a real kind of classic thing in the city life. He ran in and he said, "They're throwing stones at the Negro's house. They're throwing stones. You got to see this." But if you're city people, you know that when someone says that to you, well, you got to see this. And so he came down the stairs, and he came out onto the front porch right across from the suites. And as he came out on the front porch, he was hit right above the knee with a bullet. The other person who was hit, his name was Leon Briner. He lived about halfway down the block, and it's a really long block. He lived halfway down the block, and it was a warm night. He had been sitting out with his wife out on the front porch, but he couldn't see anything because it was a long block, and he couldn't see the action. So he had come down the block to see what was going on. And he had stopped at that corner house, the same house, right directly across from the suites, talking to the people on the front porch. He had his back turned to the suites house. And one shot hit him straight in the back. Passed straight through him. And it killed him. He died out on that lawn. And it was at that moment that the police then burst into action. They raced inside the Sweets' house, and they arrested all 11 African-Americans, Dr. Sweet, Mrs. Sweet, both brothers, all their friends, and within a day and a half had charged every single one of them with first-degree murder. And that's where the story should have ended, right there. Just one more entry into America's long list of racial injustices. And it's where the story would have ended, except for one great stroke of luck. 2 days after the Sweets were arrested, one of the big New York City newspapers published a tiny little article, literally one paragraph long, it's about this long. Headline is something like, 11 Negroes Arrested in Detroit. And I will guarantee you that 99% of the people who read that newspaper that morning didn't even notice it. One person in the city of New York noticed that story. And he just happened to be one of the most important figures in American civil rights history, and to this day, most Americans don't know his name. His name was James Weldon Johnson. Well, okay, you know his name. And he was then the head of the most important civil rights organization in the United States, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And for a whole bunch of reasons that I won't go into, James Weldon Johnson took a look at that little story and he said, "We'll defend them. When the Sweets go on trial for first-degree murder in a Detroit courtroom, the NAACP will defend them." And that was the stroke of luck. Well, it was the first stroke of luck, because there's one more I may just mention. Now, in those days, not like today, but in those days, the NAACP didn't yet have its legal defense fund. It didn't have its own lawyers. So when it took cases, court cases, it had to go hire lawyers. And so they decided they were going to hire a lawyer to defend the Sweets. And James Weldon Johnson and his associate, a man by the name of Walter White, decided right off the bat, essentially, that they wanted a white lawyer. Because they knew, and they were right about this, that when this case went to trial, all the jurors were going to be white. And they felt that they would have a much better shot in getting the Sweets off if they had a white lawyer defending them rather than an African-American lawyer. So they went out to hire a white lawyer. Problem was, they couldn't get one. They went to most of the major lawyers in the city of Detroit, and one by one, the white lawyers said, "We don't want this case, because this is a loser of a case. African Americans kill white guys in the city of Detroit in 1925. This is not a case you want." 3 weeks to trial, the NAACP still didn't have a lawyer to defend the Sweets. And then they got one. He was actually a decent lawyer. Okay. He was actually the greatest criminal defense attorney in the United States. His name was Clarence Darrow. Now, Clarence Darrow, when he took the Sweets case, was an old man. He had had a long and distinguished, or depending on your perspective, infamous career defending people other people didn't want as neighbors. He had started out his criminal defense career defending labor leaders, then not the most popular of people. His first major client was a man by the name of Eugene Victor Debs, the leader of the Socialist Party. Darrow defended another radical labor leader, a man by the name of Big Bill Haywood, who was the president of the most radical American union in its entire history, the IWW. He had defended two labor activists, the McNamara brothers, who had been accused in 1907 of bombing the Los Angeles Times building. Los Angeles Times was an infamous anti-union employer. The bomb had gone off killing a dozen people. And the McNamara brothers were accused of planting the bomb, and Darrow defended them. That one actually didn't go that well. McNamara brothers had bombed the Los Angeles Times building. In 1924, Clarence Darrow, defended two young men accused of the most heinous of crimes. Their names were Leopold and Loeb, and they had murdered a child just to see if they could get away with it. In the summer of 1925, Clarence Darrow had defended another young man accused of another heinous crime. His name was John Scopes, and he had the crime of teaching evolution in a high school science class. It's nice to know how much things have changed in America. Clarence Darrow's next case after the Scopes trial was the defense of Ocean and Gladys Sweet. In November of 1925, he came to Detroit to defend 11 African Americans on the charge of first-degree murder. And I'm not going to tell you what happened, because I wrote this book. Not only is it for sale, but I have two kids I need to send to college. No, I'm not going to tell you what happened. But I am going to tell you just a couple little things. Clarence Darrow really was something of an amazing lawyer. He didn't know much law. He had gone to the University of Michigan Law School. And I teach at Ohio State, so I got tenure, actually, just for delivering that line. He didn't know much law. He didn't even like the law. He didn't like being a lawyer. What Clarence Darrow loved was the power of words. And that's what he brought into that courtroom. Now, the NAACP was right. When the case went to trial, they did, in fact, have 12 white men in the jury box. And among the various things that Clarence Darrow tried to do in the course of that trial was to make those 12 white men feel, not think about, not consider, but feel what it meant to be a black man in the American South. To feel the fear as you hear the mob. To taste the fear deep in your throat. To smell the stench of burning flesh. And then he did one other thing. Clarence Darrow's great genius in a courtroom was not, in fact, arguing out the case. It was in his closing statements to the jury. Because, of course, at that point, he had the stage to himself, and that's what he loved most. And he was famous for those closing statements in his trials. And he says in his autobiography, which he wrote in the 1930s, he said that his closing statement to the suite in the Sweet case was the best he ever gave. So what I thought I would do is just give you that closing statement. It's 7 hours long. Ready? Okay. This is the closing of the closing statement. I may not be true to my ideals always, but I believe in the law of love, not in the law of hate. I believe you can do nothing with hatred. I would like to see a time when man loves his fellow man and forgets his color or his creed. We'll never be civilized until that time comes. I know the Negro race has a long road to go. I believe the life of a Negro has been a life full of tragedy, of injustice, of oppression. The law has made him equal, but man has not. I know there's a long road ahead of him before he can take the place which I believe he should take. I know that before him there is suffering, tribulation, and death among the blacks and perhaps among the whites. I'm sorry. I would do what I can to avert it. I would advise patience. I would advise toleration. I would advise understanding. I would advise all those things which are necessary for men to live together. And that's all. Right there. Right there you can hear it. The promise that America's racial dilemma can be solved. Can be solved by toleration. Can be solved by understanding. Can be solved by the transformation of the human heart. Right there. You hear the promise of redemption. But the thing is, redemption never came. Because it's true, it's absolutely true, that the Southern system of segregation, the system of segregation that was consolidated when Ocean was a boy, is dead and gone. Destroyed by the most important social movement in the American experience of the 20th century, that Southern Civil Rights Movement I started out talking about today. That system of segregation is dead and gone. But the Northern system of segregation, the system of segregation that Ocean and Gladys confronted 80 years ago, is still firmly in place. And of all the cities in America, none is more segregated than Detroit. And in that sense, Clarence Darrow got it just right. That until that system of segregation is dead and gone, we are not a civilized people.
You've been listening to a program from the Metropolitan Community College Diversity Matters Film and Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Kevin Boyle, professor of history at Ohio State University, and author of Arc of Justice, A Saga of Race, Civil Rights, and Murder in the Jazz Age. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 2nd, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shayla O'Connor, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at Metropolitan Community College, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.